helpful in discrediting her self-defense allegation. Probably because there was nowhere else to look, I decided to wade through the pages and started reading the contents whenever I could find time. Because I was carrying a caseload that included other prosecutions, I had to carve out reading time in between my court appearances, witness interviews, phone calls, and filing of responsive pleadings. I am methodical when it comes to reading case materials, and I have acquired habits that help me with this tedious process. I close the door to my office to avoid the need to constantly look up every time someone walks by and to muffle the noises from the copy machine just outside my door. I turned off the ringer on my cell phone so I could devote my full attention to the materials, and with a black rollerball pen in hand, I began to read. I started my review by looking at Arias's employment history, which showed that she had worked mostly as a food server in various restaurants in Arizona as well as California. It struck me that she was probably doing a job she did not enjoy, as she had floated from restaurant to restaurant, only staying for several months at each. Her more recent employment records included documented disciplinary actions that, in at least one case, had resulted in her termination. Mimi's Cafe in Mesa had fired her for unpleasantness and services issues. As she acknowledged in one of her journals, "I got 2 complaints in 3 days. They said I wasn't smiling enough and that I didn't seem happy. That's probably the case." Employment records from P.F. Chang's China Bistro, also in Mesa, showed that her lack of attentiveness towards her tables has led to refills being missed. The owner of the Purple Plum in Wairika, one of the 2 places Arias had been employed just prior to Travis's death, told the defense investigator that she, Arias, was not attentive and wouldn't take care of her customers, except for males. He also complained of having to redirect her to wait on customers to do her job, as well as her refusal to work on Sundays. While her inconsistent work history did not touch on the issue of her self-defense claim, it did offer a small window into Arias's life away from Travis. She approached her work unenthusiastically, not caring about the quality of her service, perhaps because she knew the next server job was just an application away. I then turned my attention to reading about Arias's educational history. According to her academic transcripts, she had dropped out of Wairika High School after her junior year, and there was no record that she had ever returned to obtain her diploma or that she had earned a GED. Looking closely at her transcripts revealed that she had been achieving top grades and accolades from all of her teachers during her freshman and sophomore years, and was enrolled in honors English courses for both years. But her academic performance dropped dramatically in the 11th grade, which she completed with mostly Fs and a few Ds. During her junior year, Arias had moved in with her grandparents because of tension at home with her mother. In an interview with the defense investigator, Arias's maternal grandmother, Caroline Allen, recalled waking her granddaughter up in the mornings and believing that once she left the house, she was heading for school. Only later did she learn that Jody was ditching classes to hang out with a young man named Bobby Juarez, who family members described as a high school boyfriend. Like her employment record, Arias's educational history, while interesting background, really didn't touch on the self-defense claim in any way, so I turned my attention to the conversations that the investigator had summarized with other members of Arias's family, which included her parents, Bill and Sandy, her 3 siblings, Carl, Joey, and Angela, her half-sister Julie, her maternal grandfather, Carlton Sonny Allen, a cousin, and 2 aunts. I was surprised to read that nearly everyone that the investigator spoke with echoed what Arias's parents had told Detective Flores in their initial interview with him, that Jody could be hurtful and unkind, especially to her mother. She would regularly call the house and out of nowhere berate her mother for the strangest of reasons before suddenly slamming down the phone. As the family members told it, one time Jody called her mother to say she had just gotten a haircut, When Sandy said it probably looked nice, Jody became upset and started screaming at her. Her parents also said that on at least two occasions, there were incidents that had turned physical. Bill Arias recalled one time when Jody hit her mother for no apparent reason, and he smacked his daughter in response. Arias's half-sister Julie recounted another incident when Jody and Sandy were sitting side by side. Sandy lightly touched Jody, and Jody kicked her mother in response. Arias's childhood friend, Zaina Carranzo, told the investigator of a trouble-filled relationship between Arias and her mother. She informed the investigator that she and Arias first met at Los Padres Elementary School in Salinas, California, and they remained close even after Arias moved to Santa Maria and then to Yreka. While Zaina expressed great fondness for her childhood pal, whom she described as very bright, hilarious, and like a sister to her, she admitted that when Arias got angry, she really laid into her mother, who tried to control and calm her, but Arias wouldn't listen and was grounded a lot because she was so defiant. Even when she knew the consequences, Arias just didn't care, Zaina said, telling the investigator that of Bill and Sandy's four children, Jody was the most unruly. She would say to Sandy, "I hate you. I wish you weren't my mother," Zaina recounted, remembering one time when Arias kicked a hole in the wall because her mother was angry with her. Reading through this, it was not lost on me that Zaina was the only friend who had been interviewed by the defense investigator, leading me to suspect that Arias was a person who had difficulty bonding with and keeping friends, especially women. Thinking back, this point emphasized why the police's decision to send Siskiyou County Detective Rachel Blaney into the interview room with Arias had not yielded the desired results. Arias's troubled relationship with her mother and the glaring absence of any interviews with female friends other than Zaina illustrated her inability to relate to women in the same effortless way she had of connecting with men. Other family members' interviews further complicated the portrait of Arias's relationship with her family. Her brother Carl described his sister as someone who tended to live above her means and wondered if her extravagant spending habits, such as driving an expensive car when she had no money, coupled with her tendency to overreact and blow up at people for no reason, pointed to mental illness, such as bipolar disorder. He cited as an example her out-of-the-blue phone calls to her parents' house, during which she would yell and shriek and then hang up. More interesting was the disturbance Carl described between Arias and her father after her recent move back to Yreka. Carl explained that at his sister's request, their father had rented a storage shed for her, but said she grew belligerent when she saw the unit, yelling and calling her father stupid for choosing the wrong size. Arias's cousin, Amy Lance, said Jody would be snide at family functions and speak sarcastically to others. Amy's assessment was that Jody could be a total bitch. This sentiment was echoed by Jody's maternal grandparents, the Allens, who said their granddaughter would correct the way people spoke. They mentioned that if you talked to her, you had to use perfect grammar and speech. These descriptions were in line with what her parents had told Detective Flores, and it struck me just how out of step this collective illustration was with the idyllic childhood Arias had described to Flores. The woman detailed in these records was a huge departure from the demure, soft-spoken one who had presented herself during her conversations after her arrest in Yreka and her jailhouse interviews with the national media. As I read on, a different composite began to emerge, one of a churlish grammar tyrant who was mean to her mother and seemed to derive pleasure from belittling and correcting others. Her family perceived Jody as someone who would react in unpredictable ways, even when people were being kind to her. This theme kept arising in these statements, usually as it pertained to her mother. While having a nasty temper did not prove her a murderer, It did demonstrate a pattern of behavior when it came to how she interacted with people about whom she purported to care. She could clearly be cruel, volatile, and impulsive when the mood struck her. Perhaps the most striking thing about these interviews was how replete they were with negative tales of her background. After all, this was a composite that was prepared by her defense team and meant to portray her in a positive light. Instead, the picture of her that emerged was anything but positive. Even when speaking to someone who was sympathetic to Jody's cause and trying to help her defense, it seemed her family could not help but show the true nature of Jody Arias. As I let all of this sink in, I spent a few moments preparing some notes about what I had just read before putting the folder back on the shelf and heading out for my next appointment. It was several days before I was able to get back to the materials provided by defense counsel, but I decided to shift my attention. This time, I concentrated on some of the peculiar behaviors Arias's family described around the time of Travis's memorial service in Mesa. Detective Flores had told me that Arias had traveled to Arizona to attend the memorial service, which took place a couple of weeks after police had discovered Travis's body, and that Travis's family and friends had found her presence there both strange and disturbing. What I hadn't heard was how she had behaved after the service, which was part of the interview summary from Arias's half-sister Julie. In particular, what caught my attention was Julie's recollection of a phone call she received from Jody on her way home from the airport following her return from Mesa. Jody wanted to stop by and asked what time dinner would be served. She told Julie she would be at the house in a few minutes, but more than an hour passed before she finally arrived. Julie was shocked and upset when Jody told her that she had been out shopping for bikinis and lost track of time, finding her indifference to Travis's death especially disturbing in light of the fact that she had just attended his memorial service. Even more strange was Jody's admission that she had exchanged phone numbers with a man named Nick, who was seated next to her on the flight from Phoenix to Sacramento. Julie said she was bewildered that her sister would so freely give her contact information to a stranger, and mortified when she heard them talking on the phone later that evening. Even more puzzling was that Julie never saw Jody cry after Travis's memorial service. Instead, she appeared agitated and nervous and was always on the phone. That Arias chose to go bikini shopping on her way home from Travis's memorial service raised obvious questions about what she was thinking and how she was reacting. If she had killed Travis in self-defense, it appeared she had not been upset or fazed by it, and had moved on in more ways than one. Arias's younger sister, Angela, also provided some insight. Because she was a minor, she spoke to the defense investigator in the company of her parents. Angela proudly described herself as just like Jody, explaining that they both liked to sing, they were both very musical, and they both preferred to be alone rather than with people. But there was one important detail that caught my attention as it related to Ryan Burns, the man Arias claimed to have been meeting in Utah on the day of Travis's death. Though Arias had only met Ryan once, Angela recalled Jody telling her how much she liked him, that he was her soulmate, and that she was convinced the two would get married. Arias's strange behavior following Travis's death didn't end there. Even after her arrest in Yreka, Julie found her half-sister's demeanor peculiar for someone who was facing murder charges. She said Jody was always upbeat and happy, beginning all of their calls with a cheerful, "What's up?" She next described a postcard she received from her sister in April 2009, thanking her for saying a few kind words to the Californian, referring to an article that had appeared in a Salinas newspaper. "Everyone else in the family stands by and lets me get slaughtered by ignorant, hateful, judgmental people," Arias wrote. Bill and Sandy Arias also referenced their daughter's strange contentment when they had first visited with her at the Siskiyou County Jail. "She was happy as hell," Bill recalled. Bill recounted a phone call he received from his daughter when she was told that a psychiatrist would be evaluating her in jail as part of her defense claim. He related Jody's excitement at learning that she would undergo an IQ test as part of the examination and was eager to see how close her IQ was to Albert Einstein's. "She thinks she is close to his IQ," Bill told the investigator. Her father's comment reminded me of Arias's bravado in the days after Travis's body had been discovered, when she thought she could outwit the police by offering to help with the investigation. She'd clearly had a lot of faith in her intelligence, but comparing herself to Einstein showed just how much faith she really had. Looking back over the statements of her family, it seemed clear that Arias reveled in her newfound celebrity status and seemed to enjoy being the center of attention, even if it was behind bars. She acted as if the television interviews and newspaper stories were a just reward for a major accomplishment, even if that accomplishment was killing Travis. 4 hours had passed since I'd started reading, and I had missed lunch, so I was beginning to feel hungry. I have never fallen into the habit of eating or drinking at my desk when reviewing paperwork, not even a sip of water, as I have seen too many attorneys spill liquids or leave food smudges on shirts, ties, and important documents that then can't be wiped clean. I always eat away from my desk, whether it be at our office lunchroom or downstairs at the tables outside the Change of Venue Cafe on the second floor, or at one of the restaurants near my office in downtown Phoenix, depending on how pressed for time I am. It was already past 4 p.m. when I decided to give myself a break. My body was beginning to cramp from sitting hunched over the desk, so I took the stairs down 2 levels to get the blood circulating. I was still feeling frustrated when I reached the vending machines on the second floor and bought a snack. While the information I had read thus far had been enlightening in terms of presenting another side of Arias, none of it would be useful in disproving her allegation of self-defense, and I was nearly halfway through with my read. When I got back to my desk, I moved on to the conversations the investigator had summarized with two of Arias's former boyfriends. Based on what I had already read, it was clear that her family members knew very little about her life in the 11 years since she had left home. So I looked to her boyfriends to provide the best window into what happened to her during that time. In reading these interview summaries, I learned that Arias had been involved in 3 significant relationships before Travis. The first was with Bobby Juarez, the young man she had met in the 11th grade. Her parents told the investigator that Jody stayed with her grandparents until her 18th birthday, when she moved in with Bobby and his parents in a neighboring town. There was no interview with Bobby included in the materials provided by Arias's defense counsel, and by all accounts, Arias appeared to have lost touch with Bobby after that. Also, according to the summaries, Arias's brother Carl told the investigator that his sister's next relationship was with Matthew McCartney, an individual he described as strange, with long black hair, who had an interest in the martial arts. He remembered their relationship as volatile, with the two constantly fighting, breaking up, and getting back together. The investigator followed up by speaking with McCartney, who was living in Big Sur, California, and working as a waiter at the Ventana Inn and Spa, an upscale resort where Arias had once been employed. He told the investigator that Arias had been hired to work at the Ventana Inn before he followed and was also hired. He said they lived together in a tent on the resort's campground for a short period of time. McCartney said he met Arias through her ex-boyfriend Bobby Juarez. He and Bobby were roommates, sharing an apartment in Medford, California, when she showed up there one afternoon. He saw her as perfect. Perfect body, very creative, very intelligent. Apparently the fact that McCartney and Juarez were roommates did not bother Arias, as she and McCartney subsequently went on to date for about 2.5 years. The two remained friends after the breakup. He described her as having 2 different sides, a serious side and an innocent, fun, and sweet side, acknowledging that she could be emotionally volatile and had high expectations of others. McCartney told the investigator that Arias had a lack of grammatical tolerance. He explained that she couldn't accept the way he communicated and directed him to be impeccable with his words because she needed exact communication to understand him. He corroborated this to me later when he told me during an interview in Seaside, California in July 2011 that Arias was a grammar Nazi who would constantly correct him. McCartney admitted that he would always love Arias, but said they could never be more than friends. He explained that toward the end of their relationship, he felt they needed to spend time apart, so he moved to Crater Lake in Oregon. He broke off sexual relations before he moved out. Although he tried to end the relationship, Arias was very resistant to breaking up, even going behind his back and confronting Bianca, a woman with whom he already had a nascent relationship. McCartney knew Arias's next boyfriend, Daryl Brewer, because Brewer was his supervisor at the Ventana Inn. Brewer was also the food and beverage manager who interviewed and hired Arias in 2002. He was 20 years older than Arias and had a young son from a first marriage that had ended in divorce. Even though it was getting late, I pulled out the interview summaries with Daryl Brewer. It was already after 8 p.m., and from what I could tell, I was the only person still in the office, as not even the janitorial staff are permitted to be in the building after hours. Staying late was something I had grown accustomed to over the years. The stillness of the rooms and hallways is almost meditative and provides a tranquil backdrop that enables me to concentrate more fully. But I had an early court hearing, and I was pretty much at the end of my energy stores, so I promised myself I would skim only the first few pages of the interview summaries with Daryl Brewer before calling it a night. The defense investigator documented three separate conversations with Brewer. During their initial phone call, which had been brief, Brewer indicated that he was still in touch with Arias and revealed that he had advised her not to speak to anyone, particularly the media. But he said she does what she likes, and she was encouraging friends and family to sit down with producers from 48 Hours on her behalf. Brewer's second conversation with the investigator provided a little more insight into his relationship with Arias. He admitted being impressed with her during her job interview in 2002. She carried herself well, had great presence, dressed well, was very well spoken and respectful, he recalled. Brewer recounted that he and Arias began dating about a year after her arrival at Ventana Inn, when he was no longer her manager. But after dating for some time, he decided that he couldn't get too involved with her. He had previously been married and didn't want to be exclusive because of a son from a previous marriage. Although they decided to pull back for a while, Arias kept showing up and calling him. He described her as needy at times and whiny, and sometimes she was clingy. He eventually capitulated, and the couple moved in together. They left their jobs in Northern California and bought a 3-bedroom, 2,500-square-foot house in Palm Desert, complete with in-ground pool, for $360,000. The mortgage was $2,800 per month, which they agreed to split evenly. Arias began working two jobs and, according to Brewer, faithfully paid her half until September 2006, when Brewer said she suddenly just stopped working. I saw her change in front of my eyes, he recalled. Brewer complained that Arias started to spend all her time going to prepaid legal services, motivational seminars, and meetings, leaving her no time for her restaurant jobs at California Pizza Kitchen and another restaurant, Cuisto. Soon she had maxed out all her credit cards on car payments and cash advances. That September, according to Brewer, she went to a prepaid legal convention in Las Vegas where she met Travis. She drove in the middle of the night to get there, just like she was in high school, he said, recalling that upon her return, she cut off all sexual contact with him, claiming she was now going to save herself for marriage. Arius evidently still felt comfortable enough to call him and ask for a favor less than 2 years later, in May 2008. Her favor was related to a trip that she planned to take to Mesa in June. I sat up in my chair. This statement was at odds with what she had told everybody else, including Detective Flores. As tired as I was, a surge of excitement coursed through me. According to the summary, during that phone call in May, Arius told Brewer that she was driving to Mesa, Arizona, and she wanted to borrow 2 gas cans for the trip. Arius got testy with him when he asked why she needed them. Her irritation with his inquisitiveness did not stop Arius from calling him a second time during the last week of May, when she repeated her request to borrow the gas cans for her trip to Mesa. As I read this description, I wasn't thinking about her asking for a favor or the gas cans. I was too focused on the fact that as early as May, she knew she intended to go to Mesa in June. I remembered that in her second interview with Detective Flores, Arius had mentioned that before she and Travis had sex for a second time on June 4th, they had attempted to look at photographs from their recent travels that were on a CD that she had brought with her to show him. She had the CD with her in the car, which meant she'd planned this trip. All at once, I realized her trip wasn't a spur-of-the-moment jaunt. The whole thing had been pre-planned. The fact that she'd brought the CD to show Travis and told Daryl Brewer about the trip spoke to premeditation and called into question her self-defense claim. I wanted to continue reading, but my excitement, coupled with the exhaustion I was feeling from my long day of reading, called for me to make my way home. For the first time in months, I would be able to drive home leisurely and enjoy the sounds of traffic as I merged from one freeway to another. But as I walked to my car, in the back of my mind, I kept thinking about the gas cans. At first, I hadn't thought much of them because her request to borrow them seemed innocuous, and I wasn't sure what to do with the information. The more I focused on them, though, the more significance they seemed to hold. As I pulled my car out of the parking garage, I was already trying to figure out how I was going to fit in more reading when I returned to the office the following day. I had a court appearance in the morning and knew that I wouldn't get back to my desk until around 11. I was anxious to look into why Arius had asked to borrow 2 gas cans for her trip to Mesa. After all, there were countless gas stations dotting the route from California to Arizona, so I could think of no reason why Arius would even need gas cans in the first place. Chapter 10. The following morning, I swiped my security badge past the card reader, and the barrier arm rose slowly as it granted me access into the parking garage at around 7:15. It's not that I was keeping track of the time, but I reflexively looked at my watch because I was surprised to find a space not too far from the walkway leading into our office building. I was not accustomed to seeing the garage half empty because I normally arrive about an hour later, when the only place to park is usually on the roof, where every spot is exposed to the sun. Though I was looking forward to continuing the review to see how far the Daryl Brewer summary might go, I wasn't starting the day early because of that. It was more the fitful night of sleep I'd just had, brought on by my hesitation about what to do. I wanted to tell Detective Flores that Daryl Brewer had said in an interview that Jody Arius had planned on traveling to Mesa, but I was concerned that if I shared my findings with him, he might prepare a police report detailing my impressions that would then have to be disclosed to Arius through her counsel. Because of everything I'd seen of Arius's skill at bending the truth to fit her needs, I feared that once she saw my line of inquiry, she would have time to formulate an explanation. Even if her explanation wasn't totally plausible, it wouldn't matter. All she needed was an opening, and she would be able to give a reason that would diminish the value of my discovery. Withholding this information from Detective Flores would not be easy. Since the beginning of the case, he and I had been in almost constant contact, sharing ideas and comparing notes, and in that time I'd come to rely on his judgments of Arius and the case. It would be a struggle to keep this information to myself, and as I sat down to read the rest of Brewer's summary, I felt uncomfortable about not sharing it. I returned directly to page 357 of the defense materials, where Brewer described how Arius had initially called him sometime in May to let him know that she was intending to drive to Mesa and wanted to borrow the two gas cans for her trip. He said she got testy when he asked why she needed them, and she didn't call him later in the week as she promised she would. But her testiness did not stop her from phoning him a second time in the last week of May to again inquire about borrowing the cans. During that call, she told Brewer she needed the gas cans because she was going on a long trip and she didn't want to run out of gas. Brewer recalled that a few days later, on June 3rd, Arius showed up at his house in Pacific Grove, California, near Monterey, at around 7:30 a.m. After joining him and his young son for breakfast, she asked to use his computer to check her email. I wondered if she was expecting to receive a communication from someone, perhaps Travis. After a very short visit, she was on her way by 9 a.m. with two of Brewer's 5-gallon plastic gas cans in tow. After about 45 minutes, I realized it was time for me to go to court on a different case, even though I wanted to continue reading to see where the story went. Grabbing my monthly planner and the case file, an orange folder containing the relevant documents and minute entries of any court appearances, I left my office. I had no interest in the cases being prosecuted by others that were also on the morning calendar, because my mind was back at my desk with the materials I had just been reading. While I was waiting for defense counsel to show up so that the case could be called, my thoughts were still on those gas cans. I knew police had not found them during the execution of the search warrants in Yreka, so I wondered where they were. I also found myself wondering about Arius's motivation for bringing the cans on the trip. Although the cans would have allowed her to fill up at stations in Nevada and Utah where gas was cheaper, I was pretty certain that saving money was not the true motive for taking them on the trip. Arius would still have to pay the higher price in California, and gas cans are heavy and cumbersome and can leak if not properly secured. At most, she would get a few cents a gallon in savings, which hardly seemed like a good reason justifying the inconvenience and danger of using them.
State of Arizona versus...
The judge's voice announcing my case jolted me out of my ruminations and brought me back to the matter at hand. After a discussion of procedural matters with the judge, which only took a couple of minutes, I immediately left the courtroom and walked back to my office. Although I returned expecting to get right back to my reading, other matters and repeated phone calls kept pulling me away, and it was already noon before I was finally able to return to the story about the gas cans. The summary of Brewer's interview continued on for another 3 pages, which I read slowly and carefully, but after finding nothing else related to the topic of the gas cans, I decided to take lunch. As I prepared to leave the office, a black binder labeled Police caught my attention, and I remembered that when detectives had executed the search warrant on Arius's grandparents' house in Yreka following her arrest, they had found an Airwalk brand shoebox containing some personal papers of hers, including receipts. I wondered if there were any receipts that showed the places she might have stopped for gas while on her trip to Mesa and Utah. So I called Detective Flores and asked if he could provide me with copies of everything they had found in the box. When he asked me what I was looking into, it struck me that normally I would have readily shared what I was thinking, but I wanted to protect my thoughts about what I had just read in Brewer's summary. So I trotted out an excuse, telling him I just wanted to see how long it had taken Arius to drive from northern to southern California, which was actually part of the reason I wanted to see the receipts. Flores provided me copies of the contents of the box within the week. Among other papers, there were about 15 receipts in the box. Arius had a single Washington Mutual card that could be used either as a debit card tied to her bank account or as a MasterCard credit card. I spread out a map of California on my desk so that I could visualize Arias's movements based on the story the receipts told. I recorded each receipt on a legal pad in chronological order. To help keep track of Arias's various stops, I added a running list of each destination mentioned in the receipts, starting with Redding, where she rented the car. The first receipt was for Budget Rent-A-Car System Incorporated, indicating that Arias had rented a white Ford Focus in Redding, California, on Monday, June 2, 2008, at 8:04 a.m. The detailed receipt included the rental contract, which called for the car to be returned after 4 days on Friday, June 6th, by 8:15 a.m. The same receipt indicated that she returned the car a day late on Saturday, June 7th at 1:08 p.m., after having driven it 2,834 miles. A second receipt, stamped June 2, 2008, at 8:41 p.m., indicated that Arias purchased gas at a Valero gas station in Santanella, a small hamlet of less than 2,000 people. She used her bank card to pay $20.14 for 4.751 gallons of gasoline. On the map, I noted that Santanella was approximately 272 miles south of Redding and circled both locations on the map. According to the next receipt, dated the following morning, June 3rd, Arias visited a branch of Washington Mutual Bank in Monterey, California, just after 10 a.m., where she made 3 transactions. Writing Monterey down on my legal pad and circling it on my map, I could see it was right down the road from Pacific Grove, where Daryl Brewer lived. Apparently, the bank was her first destination after she left his house. From there, Arias headed southeast to Salinas, the city where she had lived for part of her childhood. Salinas is around 20 miles, approximately a 30-minute drive, from Monterey. While in Salinas, she stopped at a Walmart that Tuesday afternoon around 3 p.m. and purchased 5 items, as shown by the receipt. I noticed that she paid cash for her items rather than using the bank card, as she had for other purchases she'd made along the trip, and spent a total of $43.90. The receipt showed that she bought 2 packages of Noxzema face pads and 2 tubes of Neutrogena SPF 85 sunscreen. The last item on her receipt was labeled 5G Caro Carb for $12.96. And by that description, it was impossible for me to tell what it was, so I called a Phoenix area Walmart store to find out. The manager I spoke to told me that the last item on that receipt was a 5-gallon gas container. He made it clear that although Caro seemed to be an abbreviation for kerosene, manufacturers of those containers use the label Caro on containers designed to carry gasoline. He told me that the CARB, C-A-R-B, notation was added to give notice that the container met the EPA carbon emissions standards. I now had confirmation that Arias had bought another gas can to add to the 2 she'd borrowed earlier in the day, but I remained unsure of what it meant. The cash transaction suggested that there was an ulterior motive for the gas cans, one that was surreptitious in nature. It was the first time I had evidence that I could use at trial to show that Arias had engaged in some sort of activity that she wanted to go undetected. I wanted to follow the path she'd left behind as far as it would take me, so I scrutinized the remaining receipts to see if there was any other anomaly about her trip. Arias's next destination was Pasadena, a city about 300 miles south of Salinas. According to the store receipt, her initial stop in that city was at a CVS pharmacy, where she checked out at 8:31 p.m. after buying over-the-counter medications and water, all with her bank card, no cash. Approximately 10 minutes later, she bought an egg salad sandwich at Starbucks, also using her bank card. But with the next string of receipts, the paper trail created even more questions. After Starbucks, Arias drove to a nearby Arco gas station, where she made 3 separate gasoline purchases from the same station. With the first purchase, Arias used her bank card, choosing not to go inside, but rather to use the Payment Island Cashier, PIC, the machine where the gas pumps are located that will take either cash or debit and credit cards. Arias dispensed 8.301 gallons and paid a total of $35.06, completing that transaction at 8:42 p.m. Interestingly, there was a transaction fee of 45 cents assessed because she chose to use her bank card. If the point of using gas cans was to save money, then this fee would have largely negated any savings that she might have hoped to gain. From there, things only got stranger. The next receipt was for a purchase at the same Arco and same pump, time-stamped approximately 4 minutes after the first. The receipt showed that she initiated this transaction at 8:46 p.m., but unlike the first transaction, she walked inside and paid the clerk $40 in cash for 9.594 gallons of gas, instead of continuing to use the PIC, where she had just used her bank card. This was enough to fill two gas cans. After Walmart, this was now the second time that she had paid for something involving the gas cans in cash. Seeing the pattern, I began to suspect that anything associated with the gas cans was going to be a cash sale. I couldn't imagine what her motivation was, but I hoped a review of the rest of the receipts would make it clear to me. I looked through the rest of the receipts and found a third purchase at that same Arco only 7 minutes later at 8:53 p.m. It involved the same clerk as the previous purchase and was also a prepaid transaction for $20 in cash, which bought the equivalent of approximately 5 gallons of gas. She ended up only buying 2.774 gallons, costing $11.56, so I immediately surmised that this final gas can probably still had some gas in it, which could have come from either an earlier stop or from there being some gas in the can when Daryl Brewer gave it to her. In all three instances, she used the same pump, number 2, which left me visualizing Arias going back and forth between the pump and the mini-mart like wipers on a car windshield. The difference was that I knew the purpose of the windshield wipers was to wipe away the rain. With Arias, shuttling between the pump and the clerk made no sense and seemed random. Although her behavior seemed odd, without more information it didn't prove anything. At this point, all I had were some receipts from California and a map with circles around the cities. I had no idea if Arias had taken the gas cans any farther than Pasadena. While I didn't find any more receipts from gasoline purchases in California or any at all from Arizona, there were two gas receipts from transactions made in the early morning hours of June 6th in Salt Lake City, Utah. These purchases took place 3 days after Arias's June 3rd stop at the Arco station in Pasadena. Since I knew that she traveled to Arizona in that time, this left me with two possibilities for the lack of receipts between June 3rd and June 6th. Either she had purchased gasoline elsewhere and had thrown the receipts away, or she had used the gasoline in the cans from the Arco in Pasadena rather than stop at another gas station along the way. Her gas purchases resumed at a Tesoro gas station in Salt Lake City on Friday, June 6th, starting at 3:57 a.m. The first receipt was for a pay-at-the-pump transaction of $41.18 for 10.672 gallons. Arias then walked inside and paid at the counter for another purchase of gasoline 7 minutes later at 4:05 a.m., as shown by the second receipt. This time she pumped 9.583 gallons for $36.98. In both instances, she used her bank card to pay. I was convinced that she still had the third gas can with her at this point in her trip, but the amount of gas purchased in Salt Lake was consistent with having only filled two gas cans. I reviewed all the receipts one more time to make sure I had not missed one, but there was nothing there indicating any more purchases in Salt Lake City. By all appearances, it looked like she hadn't used the third gas can during that stop, and I had no way of knowing whether it was in her possession for the remainder of the trip. The rest of the shoebox receipts were miscellaneous purchases, including for food, and added nothing to further advance the inquiry. As I reviewed the last few documents in the box, I came across something I hadn't seen before, an undated letter that had been written by Travis Alexander to Arias. "Dear Jody, a note, a note, a note, blah, blah, blah," it began. Maybe it's ego and pride, then, that constrain me from being so personal. I am very a matter of fact with you, towing the line, sort of speak. I know at times it makes me seem without soul. Who knows? I think sometimes I am. Let me just be short and uncharmingly sincere. You are a person of great worth and potential. There's difference to be made in the world by you. All of us, most of us, our entire lives, walk the earth shrouded in heavy locks and chains of self-doubt, limitation, and despair, holding tightly and unconsciously in our hand the key to the locks and chains. It only drops from our hand with death, or when it is, has, finally been used to free us from those binding self-limitations. I hope you will take this interregnum from who you have been and who you really are and never look back. To be ruled by your best self, to yield your best results. Remember, everything is perfect and there is a road in front of you that leads to an exceptional life. I love you. Sincerely yours, Travis. The letter itself didn't add much to the investigation, but its inclusion with the receipts in the shoebox sitting on the bed appeared to give it significance. It was as if Arias had prepared the items in the shoebox for police to find in the event she were arrested. The letter would show that she had no motive to kill Travis because its content and tone seemed to indicate they had a wonderful relationship. The receipts supported her story that she had not been in Arizona at the time of the murder. As she told her mother when Sandy had asked her if she had gone to Arizona, she was nowhere near Arizona, and she had the gas receipts and everything else to prove it. I spent the next several weeks trying to figure out other ways to see whether or not the third gas can Arias bought in Salinas had actually made the trip with her. It wasn't until a couple of weeks later when I opened the file cabinet to put away a copy of a motion from Arias's defense attorneys that I noticed a purple folder. It caught my attention because I don't normally use purple folders for my cases. The tab on the folder was labeled Washington Mutual, and the handwriting belonged to my legal assistant. The folder appeared to have been misfiled, so I figured I would put it away in its rightful place. When I looked inside to see where it belonged, I noticed they were Washington Mutual bank statements for Jody Arias. I browsed through the statements until I came to one which covered the period from 6:01:08 to 6:30:08, the time of Arias's trip. But it didn't show any transactions for June 6th, the day Arias bought gas at the Tesoro station in Salt Lake City. I was momentarily disappointed until I noticed three transactions identified as MC Tesoro 62097, Q39 Salt Lake City, Utah, that had been logged in on June 9th. Because of the rental car records, I knew that Arias was already back in Yreka by then, so I wondered if the date on the statement was incorrect. I called Washington Mutual, now part of J.P. Morgan Chase, to get more information about those entries, and a bank employee informed me that because they did not typically record transactions over weekends, they were left as pending until the following Monday. This meant that transactions that may have occurred on Friday, June 6th, would not have been recorded until the following Monday, June 9th, as indicated by the bank records. I then called Tesoro Corporation, and a representative named Chelsea Young confirmed that all three transactions had been on June 6th. Young told me that the first charge was for $41.18 for 10.672 gallons of gas. The second charge was in the amount of $19.65 for 5.091 gallons of gas, and the last transaction was for $36.98, representing 9.583 gallons. I recognized the first and third transactions from the Tesoro receipts, but the second transaction for $19.65 was new to me. An expletive escaped from my lips as I took in that number. $19.65, the cost of filling the third gas can in Salt Lake City. I now knew she had carried the third gas can with her for the entire trip, and realized that Arias had used the cans to avoid having to put gas in the car in Arizona, so that she could drive through the state undetected and no one would know that she had killed Travis. In order to back up this theory, I decided to mathematically compute the gas usage to see if the extra 15 gallons would have allowed her to make it through Arizona without stopping for gas. My research indicated that the 2008 Ford Focus had a fuel tank capacity of 13.5 gallons with a U.S. Department of Energy fuel economy rating of 24 miles city per gallon and 35 miles per gallon on the highway. This meant that the car had a minimum range of 324 miles and a maximum range of 472.5 miles to its tank, depending on whether it was city or highway driving. Arias's three gas cans represented an extra 15 gallons, which increased the car's minimum driving range an additional 360 miles to 684 miles. Between the gas tank in the car and the cans, Arias had at least 25.868 gallons of gasoline when she left the ARCO station in Pasadena, meaning she could drive a minimum of 620.83 city miles and a maximum of 905.38 highway miles without stopping to buy fuel. The approximate distance between Pasadena and Mesa is 400 miles of mostly highway driving. Interstate 10 eastbound through the Sonoran Desert is mostly flat with no city driving. There is a checkpoint just east of the California-Arizona border, but it is only for trucks and passenger vehicles are not required to stop there. The distance from Mesa to Las Vegas, Nevada is approximately 300 miles, and Highway 93 North is the shortest route. It includes minimal city driving through Wickenburg and Kingman, both cities in Arizona. The total distance from Pasadena to Las Vegas via this circuitous route through Mesa is roughly 700 miles, well within the fuel range of Arias's Ford Focus and the extra 15 gallons in her three gas cans. There was no doubt in my mind that Arias had gone through a similar computation, and that's why she made the stop in Salinas to buy the 5-gallon gas can. The cans were not in the rental car when she returned it a day late, on June 7, 2008. The agent who originally rented the car to her conducted a walk-around inspection, documenting that the car had been driven 2,834 miles, which surprised him because he remembered Arias telling him that she was only renting the car to drive around town. The gasoline cans had been her silent companions as she drove through the night. The extra gallons had assured that she would drive undetected through the Arizona darkness. The only other person who knew about the gas cans had been Daryl Brewer, and she had no reason to think that he would alert police that she had borrowed them. She thought he still loved her, and she was right, as shown by his comment to the defense's investigator that he wished they were together now. Arias appeared to have thought of everything, but one thing that she could not have foreseen was that her defense counsel would turn over these interview summaries. The detail that Daryl Brewer had lent her two gas cans turned out to be the key in unraveling her plan to travel to Arizona undetected, and it exposed that she planned the murder of Travis Alexander. Premeditation refers to a person's thoughts before they act on them. It is characterized by planning prior to carrying out an objective, such as murder. Buying the third gas can was not the only step Arias would take to achieve her ultimate goal of ending Travis's life. But as helpful as those containers were in carrying out her plan, they would be her undoing when she took the witness stand at trial. Chapter 11. Although my discovery of the three gas cans went a long way toward disproving Jody Arias's self-defense claim, I still faced an uphill battle with Travis's offensive instant messages and the 10 highly inflammatory Bob White letters. The risk with each of these was palpable. Circumstances like these can be challenging for the prosecution in a jury trial because jurors can be forgiving if they view the accused as the one who has been victimized. Juries have been known to show compassion even to someone accused of first-degree murder when presented with evidence that paints the deceased victim in a bad light. Sometimes this compassion can motivate them to return a guilty verdict on a lesser charge, such as manslaughter, or, in an extreme case, even an acquittal. The materials that showed an unflattering side of Travis's character hung like a dense fog, making it difficult to discern Arias's conduct through the haze. But instead of rushing forward and blindly defending Travis's reputation by saying, "He wasn't like that," or arguing, "This behavior wasn't in line with who he was," I decided to focus my attention on the materials themselves rather than get drawn into the specific allegations they contained. I started with the Bob White letters. When I sat down to read them again, my task was made more difficult because they were second-generation copies, and the writing was faint in many places. Experience had taught me that any item appearing under such dubious provenance needed to be viewed with suspicion. I wanted to give these letters a closer read on the off chance that I might identify any irregularities. It didn't take long to see that there were numerous problems with the letters. For one thing, the misdeeds detailed in them seemed to be described too specifically, and the prose seemed unusually stilted. What also caught my eye was that none of the letters, which had been written on unlined 8.5 by 11 inch paper, had creases, which surely would have been present had they been folded and put in an envelope for mailing. Thinking back to the letter from Travis to Arias that had been found by police in the Airwalk shoebox, I noticed that these 10 letters were all dated in the upper right-hand corner, whereas the one from the Airwalk shoebox was undated. I also observed that the language and word choices in these letters did not seem consistent with the language of that Airwalk shoebox letter, or for that matter, with the entries I had read in Travis's journal. I decided to put the letters in chronological order by date to see if anything else of note stood out for me. As I examined the dates and the content of the letters, I immediately realized there was a major error in the date of the most damaging one. This mistake added to my suspicion that all 10 of the letters were forgeries. Comforted by that discovery, along with all the other inconsistencies I'd found, I decided to follow up with a more scientific approach and see if the Bob White letters could be discredited by handwriting analysis. I set out to locate anything original that Travis had written and signed so that a handwriting analyst at the Arizona Department of Public Safety, which is contracted to handle all handwriting analyses for the Mesa Police Department, could make a comparison to the Bob White letters. I began my search by calling Travis's family and friends to see if anybody had kept any of the letters he may have sent to them. After a bit of calling around, I soon learned that one of Travis's old girlfriends, Deanna Reed, had saved all the letters Travis had written to her while she was on an LDS church mission to Costa Rica from June 2001 to November 2001. At the time, Deanna was 20 and Travis was 21, and they had broken up by letter in the summer of 2001. They had been apart for a while, and Travis was thinking of dating someone else. After Deanna returned from her mission about 6 months later, they rekindled their relationship and dated exclusively until 2005, when Deanna expressed a desire to get married and Travis told her he wasn't ready. The breakup was amicable and the two remained close friends. I'd never spoken to Deanna myself, but I knew from police reports that she had been close to Travis. Of all his friends, she was the one who ended up caring for his pug, Napoleon, after his death. The police had already met with her and determined she had no useful information about the killing. When I called Deanna to schedule a time to meet and collect the letters, she had other news to share. Some weeks earlier, Arias's two attorneys and their investigator had shown up unannounced at her house in Riverside, California. According to Deanna, they failed to identify themselves as Arias's counsel and were vague about their motivation, telling her only that they wanted to speak with her because they were somehow involved in the Jody Arias case. They wanted to ask questions about Travis. Deanna recounted that the three of them assured her that their conversations would not be on the record. She also remembered that the female defense attorney was being very chummy, seeming to imply that their discussion would be just between us girls. Deanna explained that during the visit, defense counsel had allowed her to read one of the Bob White letters, and Deanna recalled initially becoming upset at the reproachful things it said about her. But as Deanna kept reading, she noticed word choices and phrasing that Travis would never use. Although the handwriting resembled Travis's, she believed the letter to be a forgery. It appeared that this surprise visit did little to assist Arias's defense team. Even after reading the unflattering things Travis had supposedly written about her, Deanna had nothing disparaging to say about him. That the defense team had presented themselves to Deanna in this ambush-type fashion told me they didn't have anyone to corroborate the allegations in the Bob White letters. As I listened to Deanna's story over the phone, it became clear just how important the genuine letters in Deanna's possession were. With seemingly no one on Arias's side to verify the truth of the White letters, a handwriting comparison showing they were forgeries could be enough to have them excluded as evidence. Deanna's letters were so crucial that I decided to make the 5-hour trip to Riverside that very day to pick them up, because I didn't want a chance their getting lost in the mail. Deanna agreed to see me that afternoon, so I began the drive to Southern California within minutes of hanging up the phone. Deanna came out to greet me before I could knock on the front door of the house she shared with her parents. I had not met her before, so I had no idea what she looked like, and I didn't know what to expect. She was dressed casually in jeans and a blouse, her straight black hair falling past her shoulders, and she immediately put me at ease with a welcoming smile.